All right, welcome everyone. It's Sunday afternoon. This is Revolution Radio's Cancel the Cabal. I'm Stephen Roberts. I have a very special guest up with me today. He's been on the show at least once other that I can remember. Maybe he can remember when I bring him up. Maybe he can remind me. But I have David Livingstone. He's an author. He's a researcher. College graduate. Not that that's really going to make a big difference, but sometimes it can give you some street cred. His books are Terrorism and the Illuminati, The 3,000-Year History, The Dying God, The Hidden History of Western Civilization, and Black Terror, White Soldiers, Islam, Fascism, and the New Age. So, welcome to the show once again, David.
Thanks, Stephen. Nice to be back.
Yes, it is. A little bit of a new thing to you there. That last little intro there was what they made for me at Revolution Radio, and it kind of goes into a little bit of what we're going to be talking about today. It goes into the secret societies. If you heard the intro there, talks about the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and secret societies and that, and that's right what we're going to be talking about today. We mentioned just before the show, David posted something on his Facebook page, which is what was your Facebook page again? It was Black Terror, White Soldiers?
No, it's actually David Livingston, author.
Oh, David Livingston, author. Okay. Yeah. But you posted a link to a book. Yeah. And the book's by Charles Higham, 1983, Trading with the Enemy, an expose of the Nazi American Money Plot, 1933 to 1949. Yeah. Why did you post that on your wall?
I guess what I, you know, an important part of what I discovered writing my latest book is that I tried this time around to be even more careful in my use of sources. So everything that came up, I just dug a little more carefully and dissected anything that came along just for an added degree of verification. And how that paid off is that I started to recognize the degree to which conspiracy culture is being manipulated, and very much how it's an essential tool for steering American politics. And to jump to the point, the Tea Party is a very important example. So I wrote an article recently that kind of summarized some of the bits that I mentioned in my book. And at the risk of offending certain listeners, a key agency in this plot is the John Birch Society, which has extensive links with American intelligence. And in particular, they were responsible for popularizing the work of Cleon Skuzin, who wrote The Naked Communists, which supposedly exposed the communist sort of infiltration or conspiracy in the United States. But in reality, the conspiracy party in the United States is a tool, has been a tool, longstanding tool of the CIA, and was a tool of American intelligence long before even the advent of the CIA, beginning with Jay Lovestone. So, to jump back to another point, it was Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism, who basically said that a devious idea came into his mind, that to provoke the Jews into accepting the creation of the state of Israel and basically leaving their countries of residence and emigrating to Israel, he said that he was going to use anti-Semitism, that the anti-Semites were going to be the best friends of the Zionists. So from what I see is that the truth is that most of CIA history over the last half century or more has been one of collaboration with fascists and Nazis and neo-Nazis on many fronts, and we can get to that in a bit. And and as you know, the Nazis largely came to power by promoting the Protocols of Zion. And this is another thing that I go into in my book, which I show that the Protocols of Zion were a product of the Memphis Mizraim Rite of Freemasonry. So I think everybody, you know, most conspiracy researchers recognize that there's a great deal that must be truthful about the protocols, but that's not what's important. Important is how it is used. So the point was, of course, to create blame for the Jews in general, and pointing the finger of blame away from the true culprits. And that's being used to a large extent in the United States, particularly in the promotion of conspiracy theories, in order to create criticism of policies that can be identified as communism, in order to nurture acceptance of ideas that they want to promote, which are actually fascist in origin. And a prime example is that of neoliberalism. So to get back to your question, the Charles Heim's book shows to what extent American corporation, principally Standard Oil, which was headed by the Rockefellers, and its many sort of subsidiaries or related or corporations, principally IG Farben, which was the leading conglomerate in Germany at the time, how these companies were involved in essentially bringing about the rise of the Third Reich, which was a key strategy for a number of reasons, mainly, or one important component was to bring about the creation of the State of Israel and creating an atmosphere of anti-Semitism, which was going to support that project. And then beyond World War II, there's what has come to be known as the Fourth Reich, which has been the ongoing relationship with Nazis and neo-Nazis. And most importantly, that relationship evolved into what is known as Operation Gladio, which is an international network of fascist organizations who have been used as an anti-communist front to carry forward CIA covert policies, largely to push forward neoliberal policies around the world.
Yes, David, but I understand blaming it on the communism is just a worthy scapegoat. But isn't it, when it boils down to it, isn't it a corporate run collectivism agenda?
You know, I'm not sure exactly what kind of end product they have in mind. You know, I mean, fundamentally, communism is based on the idea of a distribution of wealth, which, of course, is the diametrical opposite of what they want to create. They want to create an elitist system. And if anything, it's really the principles of fascism which more closely align to what their objectives are, which is mainly, you know, it fundamentally comes down to belief in that of a survival of the fittest. Everyone should take care of themselves. The idea of perpetual war, which is a very important aspect, especially adopted by the neoconservatives. So from what I see is that, you know, I mean, in the end, what are you going to call it anyway? I think both avenues are kind of two different paths of the Hegelian dialectic that are going to be used to bring about a resolution of their real project, which is a new world order. So however you want to define that, I don't think really communism or fascism will likely truly apply.
Yes. What does your research of trading with the enemy, what does Chaim get into?
He goes into a lot of detail. Somebody mentioned Franz Claus who mentioned that you know, another important book is Anthony Sutton's Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. Chaim's book is very detailed and goes into a lot of specific and makes a pretty damning case. But I think what's more important is the picture in general. And I talked about this on a couple of other radio shows, but if you look at the rise of the Nazi Party, it basically grew out of the Sabbatian network. the Sabbatean occult network, which finds itself in the occult revival in groups like the Golden Dawn and the teachings of Edward Buller-Litton, H.P. Blavatsky, and that evolves into the Thule Society of Germany, and which was founded by Rudolf von Sabbatendorf, who studied with the Domine Sabbateans of Turkey. And the simultaneous trend here is that of synarchism. I think we talked about this in the last couple of shows. So synarchism is basically synarchism and fascism are essentially they're twin aspects of the same tradition, or fascism is basically an outgrowth of the synarchist tradition.
Yeah, I never actually heard of that word until you said it on the first show.
Yeah, so I hadn't really discovered it until researching my third book. As I mentioned, I heard it mentioned a few times, but never in enough detail that I could recognize the significance of it. But I've since realized that it's basically integral, and that synarchism takes us from the Sabbatean networks of Frankists in the 18th century with the Martinist orders right up until Leo Strauss and the neoconservatives. So it's basically the true underlying continuity that maintains this tradition. And it's at the same time, the tradition which feeds the fascist tradition that is in collaboration with the CIA and their principal strategies throughout the Cold War. So what happens is, just to make a brief summary, basically synarchism begins with an occultist by the name of Saint Eve. And so synarchism is supposed to be the ideal political system which is used in the Hollow Earth. And this is where it connects to Edward Buller-Litton's theory of the Vril, and why the Nazis also had a society by that name called the Vril Society that Karl Haushofer belonged to. So this is this entire network that connects all these people. Karl Haushofer was a protege of George Gurdjieff, and Gurdjieff was a character of several influences, mainly sort of a pseudo Sufi influence by way of what he called the Sarmung Brotherhood, but he also had a dual role. He also went by the name of a Lama Dorjeff, who was responsible for various British strategies in Tibet through the office of the Dalai Lama, which again is what connects the Nazis with the Dalai Lama and Tibetan Buddhism. And so we have Karl Haushofer and Rudolf Hess, who basically were two partners in crime. Rudolf Hess was a member of a synarchist organization as well. This links them now to the key representatives, which was Halmar Schacht, who was the head of the Reichsbank, and Montague Norman, who was the head of the Bank of England. So basically, they're kind of the chief exponents of the synarchist tradition at the time, and they represent really the nexus of American-British collaboration with the Nazis, which again then extended to Standard Oil, which was headed by the Rockefellers, and a number of other key organizations. Now, as I mentioned in my post, the key organization behind all of this was the Skull and Bone Society. And as is probably well known, both of George W. Bush's grandfathers were indicted for what was considered the crime of assisting the Nazis. So I can't really go into much detail because, I mean, if anybody's interested, all the details are in Haim's book. They're pretty extensive. So I just wanted to give a general overview because that's really just the beginning of the story.
Oh, yes. Well, that's understandable. You'll have to do your own research and then write your own book, right? But anyways, I think I know what the answer to this question is, but maybe some others don't. Why is it important to blame communism instead of the fascism, instead of the neocons on the right?
Because communism, basically anything that they want to attack, they can just label as communism. So if they want to create greater inequality, if they want to undermine, if they want to undermine the economic class of the economic power of the lower classes or middle classes, any policies that support it, they can label as communism. They can basically label anything communism that they want to attack, and that's basically what they do. So labor unions are communism, healthcare is communism, any kind of program, regulation of industry of corporations is communism. If you want to stop major corporations from polluting or exploiting workers or, you know, not paying them enough, or you just call it communism, that's basically what they do. Yeah. Because ultimately fascism is sort of the economic philosophy of fascism is to concentrate power into the corporate class out of their belief in that life is survival of the fittest. So, the corporations have kind of earned their right to be the elite of society in a sense.
Okay, David, do you know you have a lot of background noise somewhere?
I do. I'm sorry about that.
A lot of rustling around maybe or? But anyways, how would you define the characterize the differences between fascism and communism?
Pardon?
How would you characterize the differences between fascism and communism?
They're both products of Sabbatean occultism. Communism basically just takes what has been an essential human value that goes back thousands of centuries, which was breached by Christianity and, of course, Judaism and Islam as well, which is charity. So the idea of charity and redistribution of wealth is an idea which is independent of communism. But, I think that's just the sugar coating of the poison pill. Marx, as Rabbi Ackerman has shown, was a Sabbatean and obviously a recruit. I think I won't speak too quickly. Obviously, a recruit of the Illuminati and a very integral plan of the Illuminati. The communism was used as a tool of the Illuminati to overthrow the Russian aristocracy and create basically what has been characterized as state capitalism in the Soviet Union. So, it was a convenient tool for Illuminati strategy in a particular situation. And it served its purpose in various parts of the world. But it's definitely not the Illuminati strategy. And it seems that for the U.S. in particular, Illuminati strategy was dependent on focusing or manufacturing an opposition to communism. So essentially, fundamentally, what's it? To go back to fascism, it's important to, in a lot of ways, an important exponent was Nietzsche. So fascism is founded on the idea that, like Nietzsche said, God is dead. So the Superman is the man who can go beyond good and evil, he can go beyond morality and invent his own morality. So fascism is basically in this post-God world where everything is survival of the fittest. So all that matters, and this is where you get sort of the basic ideals that are celebrated by fascism and why Nietzsche was celebrated by the Nazis. It basically comes down to this idea that if everything is survival of the fittest, then the highest moral virtue is the courage to pursue the advancement of your own power. And so compassion is then seen as a weakness. And this is why, these ideas are very well articulated in Nietzsche's philosophy and eventually in Nazism, which is this dichotomy between masculinity and femininity, and this idea that femininity represents everything that's weak, because at the same time, compassion represents weakness. So that extends to their criticism of communism, which sort of articulates an emphasis on compassion and support for the weak, whereas in fascism it's very opposite, where you have to have no mercy for the weak, where everything is focused on discipline, judgment, and no mercy, which is why I've articulated the notion of perpetual war, and that very much becomes the philosophy that was adopted by the CIA and eventually the neoconservatives.
Well, I've I can see some correlations where at least two similarities where fascism and communism share is first the illusion of compassion.
Yeah.
It's just a rhetorical device to say that you're compassionate about the poor or the weak or the elderly, and then turn around and do the opposite. Mm-hmm. Both sides perpetrate this fallacy, if you will.
Yeah.
And the second, which has slipped my mind now, so I will try to think of it while you're responding to the correlation there, David.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm not defending communism in any way, but I do defend some of the underlying principles of communism, which I believe are not...
Sure. They're glamorous.
The communism.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's so glamorous.
That's the problem. And that's so that, you know, to use a tired cliche, people are throwing the baby out with the bathwater, but that's precisely the intent.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's glamorous to attack the big man. The so-called corporation or whatever is the big guy, and it's glamorous. I understand it, and like I said, it's just a rhetorical device to say one thing and then do another.
Exactly. And the problem is with conspiracy cultures, they're so focused on this myth of a communist conspiracy, and now it's a Jesuit conspiracy that's being manufactured, that they completely miss the point. They completely miss exactly what's going on. And because of that, then become recruits into the very plot that they think that they're opposing.
Yes, they do. Yeah. They get caught up, and everything is glamorous. They got a movie star or a television star out there in the streets telling them what to do. And they see this television or a movie star, and they see him as their friend, and it's just the opposite, because this movie star wouldn't even look at him if it wouldn't be for this certain event or whatever.
Exactly. So there's a very fascinating story of the ongoing collaboration between the Nazis and the CIA after World War II, and that basically ties into the manufacture of conspiracy culture in the United States. If you want to get into that point.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so, you know, we talked about the collaboration between the collaboration that Haim talks about. And basically this evolves into the Red House, Maison Rouge, which is a hotel in Paris where the Nazis, seeing that they were about to lose the war, decided that they were going to start moving their assets. And the two people who were in charge of handling that was Otto Skorzeny and Halmar Schacht. So Halmar Schacht he was the head of the Reichsbank. He was the one who was mainly responsible for, maintaining the books, whereas Skorzeny was the sort of the grunt who did all the legwork and responsible for, you know, physically moving a lot of the assets from place to place. There's a fascinating story, which I talk about in my book, how he goes to, because they had an ongoing relationship with the Peróns in Argentina. So, of course, you know, it's well known that many Nazis found their way to Argentina and Chile and other parts of South America, but principally Argentina after the war and before. So the a large portion of the assets were moved to Argentina, and somehow Evita Perón convinced the Nazis to put, or did she convince her husband to transfer the funds into her name? So she thought that she was going to be able to get away with this. And so as soon as the Nazis found out, then they sent Otto Skorzeny to take care of it, because he was known for his womanly skills. So he had to go down there. And what he did is that he staged an incident where he had to rescue Evita, so that she could then she could look at him as her hero and impart her entire trust to him. And that's how he managed to get her to sign back over the funds into their name. So Otto Skorzeny, he was the star commando of the Nazi party. he was responsible for all kinds of incidents. Also, the rescuing of Mussolini, the famous rescue of Mussolini. And after the war, he temporarily managed to get away, but eventually he was about to be indicted at the Nuremberg trials, but it was the Americans who helped him get away. And from that point on, he becomes a key agent of the CIA and American intelligence throughout the world, mainly to manage this international post-war fascist network. So the two key American agents, as is well known at this time, this is when the Americans carried out Operation Paperclip, which brought most of the scientists to the United States, mainly to work with NASA. But that was really just a portion of the continuing collaboration. So the two main agents were Otto Skorzeny and Reinhard Gehlen. Reinhard Gehlen, he created what's called the Gehlen Org, and then recruited all the former Nazis who had been working against the Soviets to work now for the CIA, as I mentioned, what became known as Gehlen Org, or eventually evolved into the German intelligence known as the BND. So Otto Skorzeny now becomes a key, basically he becomes a trainer in terrorist tactics. And he travels all over the world, training various terrorist organizations in their skills. He trained Yasser Arafat, and most importantly, he trained the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, who then became the key tool of the CIA in their fight for fight against communism in the Middle East.
The false flag boogeyman, right?
Absolutely. See, the tragic thing about the use of the Muslim Brotherhood is that, like in the United States, they treated communism as atheistic, despite the fact that what communism, or not even that, but just simply leftist policies were out to ensure the rights and equality of the lower classes, they could brand as communist and then villainize it because it was supposedly atheistic. So basically, they used the Muslim Brotherhood against Islamic principles of charity by claiming that what they were fighting for was against atheistic communism. And this is what they continue to do in our time. And this is detailed in Robert Dreyfus's book about the use of Islamic banking and or a phony front of Islamic banking, which basically used, again, to carry forward American or Western economic policies in the Middle East. And they continue to use this notion of communism and socialism as being atheistic to recruit the Muslim Brotherhood. So that's an entire other branch that we've discussed before. But back to the other branch, is that Skorzeny then becomes part of what he called the Fascist International. He also created what's called a Paladin Group, which was basically a group of, it was an organization designed to train terrorist organizations. This was an international network of fascist organizations. And these became known as, well, in Italy in particular, they were known as the Gladio Network. But they came in many other names in different parts of Europe. But they were set up all over Europe. There's an excellent book that details the entire story by Daniel Ganter called NATO Secret Armies. So this was a plot operated by the CIA under Alan Dulles and NATO. And the idea was to create what they called stay-behind units. So looking at the success of the resistance in France, what they saw was the need to create native or local organizations that could rise up and fight from within in case of a Soviet invasion. So what they did is they recruited fascists in these various countries to create these organizations and supplied them with funds and and weaponry and so on and so forth. So the most famous case is the Gladio Network in Italy, which was responsible for what's called a strategy of tension. And that the whole idea of the strategy of tension is a direct outgrowth of their fascist thinking. So interestingly, this is the other tangent, which I'm not sure if we're going too far off, but you can tell me.
No. Basically, no, you're fine. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the Italian fascists were of the Gladio Networks were students of an occult figure by the name of Julius Evola. And this is the point where the synarchist tradition comes into play, because Julius Evola was a protege of René Guénon. Now, René Guénon was one of the leading occultists of the 20th century. He basically created what's called traditionalism. And it's the belief that all Esoteric religions share a single underlying esoteric tradition. So he believed that you could take on any outward religion, because in the end, if you followed its esoteric tradition, you're following the same old occult tradition. This is originally an idea that is it's actually an old idea, an old occult idea that goes all the way back to the Renaissance, known as the ancient wisdom or the Priscilla Theologia. But it was rearticulated and then referred to him as traditionalism. And it was also, well, especially through the words of Julie Savola, it was a synarchist tradition. So that links back this entire traditionalist organization. Another important point is that René Guénon converted to Sufism. And he converted, and this is where the channel of Sufism comes into this tradition, because that's what links Sufism with the New Age and so on and so forth. I find there's a lot of tangents to try to manage here.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to a subject you happened to mention a minute ago.
Yeah.
The Muslim Brotherhood and the founding of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah.
Do you think Hassan I'm probably going to butcher this name.
Hassan al-Banna.
Banna, yeah. Do you think he actually realized what was going on whenever the Brotherhood was formed? Do you think
to what extent does any member of the Illuminati realize what they're doing, right? I mean, how many of them are knowing agents of what they are ultimately doing? I think on almost the very top, they're all dupes in one way or the other.
So he was part of the power structure?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think those are really the kind of questions that should concern us. You know, we can look, you know, a name comes to mind is when, you know, you look at George Washington and Jefferson, right? There's a lot of patriots who have difficulty trying to make sense of the things that they said about the Illuminati.
Exactly. And they were master masons themselves,
exactly.
High up in the ranks.
So were they duped agents, or these are,
it's a dichotomy. Yeah.
We can't answer.
It's a paradigm that, it really can't be, I don't know.
Well, this is why, you know, I think it comes down to fundamentally, you know, the key spiritual issue, which is that we're not here to judge anybody. You know, we don't know who's good and who's bad. We judge their actions, and that's as far as we take it. This is why Jesus said, you know, cast the first stone, right? He was never sinned, cast the first stone. You know, it's not, I think there's a tendency to sort of malign the Illuminati and point the finger at, because it's easy to find somebody that you can project all your frustrations against, frankly. And I think that this is what people are looking for, somebody to kind of villainize. And again, this is why Jesus said, love even your enemy. And this is what we should do. We don't know what level of ignorance these people are involved in, or their level of culpability or whatever. It doesn't really matter. We should actually try to forgive them in our hearts. We don't forgive their actions, but we don't tolerate their actions, but we can at least forgive them.
Well,
it's like Christians say, love the sinner, hate the sin.
Yeah. I don't really know if the Muslim Brotherhood was meant to be a militant group or not, but I'm kind of theorizing that the CIA and Western interests made them into that, though, didn't they?
Definitely. I mean, you know, the guy who definitely was a knowing criminal was the man who started the entire tradition that the Muslim Brotherhood came out of, and that was Jamaluddin Afghani. This guy was a thorough, you know, through and through imposter. He was actually Shia, posing as a Sunni. He was Grand Master of the Freemasons, but then posing as an Orthodox Islamic reformer. His handler was Edward Scound Blunt, Wilfred Scound Blunt. You know, he was traveling back and forth to France, England, so on and so forth. And he admitted himself, in his own words, he said that the only way to undermine religion is to work within it. So he said, look at us, and you'll see us doing everything that we look like we're supposed to. you know, praying, fasting, you know, everything that's necessary to present the pretense of actually being a sincere member of the religion, but actually being, you know, a devoted enemy of it. So him, we know there's really, really little doubt that he was an annoying enemy, but he wasn't cognizant of his opposition to Islam. A person like Hassan al-Banna, I'm not sure, but what's curious is that John Loftus, he was given access to various CIA documents, and he discovered that that Banna was actually recruited by Hitler to create an arm of British intelligence. So, you know, the possibility that he wasn't aware of what he was doing, I find gets significantly reduced when you consider that point.
That's very interesting. Do you know much about that story? Can you expand on that?
Well, see, this is the interesting point, and this is where it really comes back to the entire origin of Nazism in the first place. And really, Nazism, so as I said, Nazism originates with the occult revival and groups like the Golden Dawn, that Aleister Crowley belonged to. So the Golden Dawn itself was influenced by another order by the name of the Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor. So one of the key influences to that order was this guy, Jamal Afghani. So Jamal Afghani was simultaneously the influence behind the rise of the Western occult societies that led to the Nazis, as well as the Masonic subversive societies that led to the Muslim Brotherhood. So essentially, Afghani and Hitler were both inheritors of the same tradition that goes back to Jamal Afghani, if you follow what I'm saying. And I'm sure that they would have been aware of this at the time.
Oh, yes, yes. I do follow what you're saying, yes.
Particularly if you consider that, you know, Afghani was also working with the Young Turks, which was a Sabbatean organization, and with close links to the Thule Society that led to the Nazis. So this was, you know, this was an international network that obviously involved Sabbateans, and I think that would have been the recognized reason for their collaboration, the collaboration between Hitler and Hassan al-Banna.
Well, this just sounds like the culmination of what Albert Pike wrote of in his book in the late 1870s, I think, wasn't it?
His prediction for three world wars.
For three. They had to create a Middle Eastern opposition. Yeah,
exactly. So first of all, I mean, that point is controversial. It's being criticized that Pike ever said anything like that. There's no proof that he wrote it. This was paraphrased by William Guy Carr.
Oh, there is no proof of that?
No. But even the fact that William Guy Carr could have said something like that in 1954 was pretty prescient.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'll leave it open to let listeners decide, but obviously that's exactly what's played out one way or the other.
Yes, well, yeah, even if it isn't true, that's what they're...
That's what the plan is.
That's the illusion that they're perpetrating.
Civilization. So.
Yeah, that's the illusion that's coming forth anyways.
Exactly.
You happened to mention Franz earlier. What did you and him have some kind of a talk or something, or...?
We just started one.
Oh, okay. Cause he
posted on my page, and, especially in response to the Chaim book. And he made the remark that, what I was talking about was actually the rise of the Fourth Reich. And I just had to agree with him, and we started from there. And that's as far as we got so far.
Yeah. Well, he's actually listening. I had him on, just last week, or no, I'm sorry, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I was just starting to listen back.
Oh, okay. Anyways, yeah, this history, it does fascinate me, but unfortunately, I don't have the kind of time that others do to actually look into and read and research. So,
I understand.
Yeah,
but you know, if I really in my latest book, I think I found so much information that I had absolutely never heard of before. And that's really what it comes down to, is that, you know, if I could be frank, I think what's really happening is hasn't really been acknowledged by the conspiracy culture. I think they're really stuck in a particular focus, and they're missing what's really going on.
Okay, Franz just popped in the chat room there, David. He said Pike's prediction was in a letter to Mazzini, not in his book.
Exactly. That's the problem. It's Carr, he wasn't a very good writer. And he rarely provides any footnotes, and so his books are a bit of a mess. And so what happens is that there's two portions in that segment. So this has been analyzed by, first of all, there's a very well-recognized article on a three-world war scenario. And then it was critiqued by Terry Melanson from Conspiracy Archive. So he did an excellent job of locating the actual sources and finding out where Carr went wrong in making that identification. So supposedly it was a letter that was found in the Library of Congress. But there's two portions that Carr is talking about. And one is the World War III scenario, and the second one is the unleashing the nihilists. So the problem is that Terry was right that the portion about the nihilists was from an incorrect, was falsely credited to the letter supposedly found in the library. But so that one is discredited. But the other portion, and this is what everybody else missed, is that the other portion, Carr did not claim derived from the from that letter, but rather he was paraphrasing what he, I can't remember where he said he got it. But one way or the other, it doesn't come from that letter to Mazzini. It's an entirely separate mention that he makes, and it's paraphrasing, and I'm not sure, he doesn't say where he derived it from.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. I guess, who knows, maybe he just made it up off the top of his head. And
yeah, that's too bad, you know, because he's a valuable writer in a lot of ways, but it's really unfortunate that he just didn't. You know, when it comes to things like this, you can say all kinds of wildly controversial things, and it might ring true in a lot of ways, but if you can't footnote it and allow people to fact check it on their own, then, you know, in the end, it's a very little value.
Well, look at this so-called movement today. You can just about say whatever you want, and you really don't have to be true and factual, and people take it as factual information.
Yeah, exactly. I'm hoping people are learning, though. I think, you know, the advent of the internet really had a dual contribution to this. You know, the positive contribution is that it makes a lot of information available, but the negative consequences that is that it makes a lot of information available, right? The problem is that people need to learn to start sifting through the information and fact-checking and double-checking stuff. But just because somebody's mentioning it somewhere doesn't obviously make it true.
No.
It's an obvious point, but I mean, there tends to be a little too quick circulation of information, which people think too quickly rings true without looking into it more closely. So there's been quite a few. You see a lot of stuff going on these days. Like there's that latest woman who claims to be from the World Bank.
Oh, yes.
Is or something like that.
Yes.
There was Leo Zagami, another supposed insider. Before that, there was Benjamin Fulford. You know, so this is very much part and parcel of what I see as the manipulation of conspiracy culture. And there are more fringe aspects, but it's even the more fundamentally accepted aspects of conspiracy culture which are manufactured.
Well, yeah, there's some of these things out. Some of these people out there are actually sanctioned to go out there and say what they're saying. They want this information out there. They have to have our approval.
Yeah.
To
we were talking earlier about the Fascist International. So there's this is, from what I see, almost completely unrecognized, and this was treated by Nicholas Goodrich Clark, who also wrote the book on Nazi, you know, probably the most authoritative book on Nazi occultism. A bit too much of a skeptic, but his book Black Sun is really fascinating, and it talks about this entire survival of neo-Nazism in the last half century. And he doesn't mention the significance of it, but at least by exposing its underlying beliefs, it's really a fascinating read. And there's two important characters in this story, and one of them is Savitri Devi. And she's a woman who converted to Hinduism, I think. She lived in India anyway. So she basically articulated this. She was one of the first exponents of what came to be known as esoteric Hitlerism. And this is the belief that, what she articulated is that Hitler was an avatar of Vishnu. And this has been, you know, interpreted, and basically this becomes part and parcel of this neo-fascist cult, or the beliefs of the neo-fascist international, which, as I've been mentioning, have been tools of CIA destabilizations around the world. One of the leading, probably the leading exponent, considered the father of esoteric Hitlerism, is Miguel Serrano, who happens to be buddy-buddy with the Dalai Lama. So what they believe is that Hitler survived World War II, and fled to Antarctica. And from there,
he went to Argentina, right?
Pardon?
He supposedly went to Argentina after that.
Well, exactly, which is very close to Antarctica, right? That's the implied notion.
Yeah.
So from there, the Nazis, as you know, there's this prevalent myth around the internet that the Nazis had somehow mastered anti-gravity and managed to create flying saucers. So this is combined with this idea and the original Vril Society idea. Well, because they're Vril machines, which ties them back to this whole notion stemming back to the occult revival and Berlin. So supposedly they're piloting flying saucers in and out of the Hollow Earth. And so this is basically their underlying mythos. Now you have all the organizations that are part of this fascist international. One key organization was the National Renaissance Party, which has links to the Church of Satan, and which Eustace Mullins belonged to.
Say, David?
Pardon? Yes?
I just wanted to remind you, I just want to tell you, we're coming up on that break in about a minute.
Break, I forget so.
In about a minute. I just didn't want to get into a whole lot until after the break, maybe.
Yeah.
But that name of that woman you were talking about is, I think it's, Fran said it was Karen Huds, or
yeah, Hudes or something like that.
Hudes, yeah, that's what it is. I didn't know the pronunciation of the of her last name there, but
so she's another one who's coming out to say it's a Jesuit and even alien-controlled Jesuits or something.
Like that. Yeah, I've got a friend that either just had her on or is going to have her on pretty soon here. And I'm kind of anxious to listen to that, but I've had some people in my group that don't really think her information is going to be all that spectacular, and I don't know. I'm thinking she might be a shill, and she might be a plant, and who knows? And there we got the music, so we'll be back after the break, everyone.
Yeah.
All right. Welcome back, everyone. As the last commercial said, we are listener supported, so please go hit that donate button. All right. Welcome back, David. We were talking about Hitlerism. What kind of... David, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Sorry.
Okay. No, we were talking about something just before the break. Remind me of the subject. Maybe we can go into it. Expand on it.
Yeah, we were talking about the esoteric Hitlerism and the fascist.
Esoteric Hitlerism, yes. Explain that first, would you please?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I was talking about Savarchi Devi, who is sort of, you know, the prophetess of this movement, who identified Hitler as an avatar of Vishnu. And then I explained that she was followed by Miguel Serrano, who is a friend of the Dalai Lama. And again, the Dalai Lama was tutored by Nazis, and so that's a history of relationship with the Nazis that goes back even before.
And he also has some ties to the CIA too, doesn't he?
Absolutely, he's funded by the CIA.
Yeah,
this is another article that I wrote about recently. I mean, this is a whole other tangent, so it's too much to get into. But basically, the office of the Dalai Lama has been an integral tool of American and first British and then American strategy in Central Asia, going back at least 100 years. And it starts again with George Gurdjieff in that part of the world. But it really begins with H.P. Blavatsky, who identified Tibetan Buddhism in particular, because there's many branches of Buddhism. And what people don't realize is that Tibetan Buddhism in particular is actually a pretty convoluted version of Buddhism, which incorporates what's known as bond shamanism, as well as Hindu tantra. And it's a very sort of occult, corrupted version of Buddhism. So Blavatsky regarded it as the only true survival of the magical tradition, or what she called the Oriental Kabbalah. So that kind of, that's the groundwork that was opened up for, because it was Blavatsky's ideas that became the founding doctrines of the Nazi Party. So that explains the groundwork of the collaboration between Tibetans and the Nazis, and most particularly the Dalai Lama. So back to esoteric Hitlerism, which also reveres the Dalai Lama and explains the role of the friendship between Miguel Serrano, who's known as the father of esoteric Hitlerism, with the Dalai Lama. And he's the one who basically articulated this idea that Hitler's survivor of World War II set up bases in Antarctica where the Nazis fly UFOs or anti-gravity machines out of the hollow earth. So why I mention this is that basically this network involves many fascist organizations, most importantly like the American Nazi Party, also a number of other American fascist and British fascist organizations. And one of them was the National Renaissance Party, which was which has links to the Church of Satan, and that's what Eustace Mullins belonged to. And of course, Eustace Mullins is the author of Secrets of the Federal Reserve, which is probably the most well-recognized critique of the Federal Reserve System, which is popular in conspiracy circles. So this is just basically to show the ongoing influence of neo-Nazism and fascism in the promotion of conspiratorial ideas. But not to discount everything that Eustace Mullins said, but just to put in context why he was saying it. And so these organizations like the American Nazi Party and so forth also have ties to other organizations in the U.S., like Aryan Nations and so on, which again have ties to the Patriot Movement, and then which leads to people like, in one branch, it leads to people like Ron Paul and the Libertarian Movement, and the other branch is the Christian Right. And the Christian Right basically arose out of the neoconservative plot to use Christianity as a Trojan horse to promote their fascist economics, which are known as neoliberalism. So the neoconservatives started out in the early 70s by seizing control, increasing their power in the American government, beginning with the Nixon administration, but most importantly with Ronald Reagan. But they were a very fringe, radical organization or group, sorry, who had no means of carrying their ideas to the rest of American society. So they used the strategy suggested by their guru by the name of Leo Strauss, who again is a leading exponent of the Synarchist tradition. And their idea was, basically Leo Strauss' idea was that people are stupid. They can't handle the truth. So you have to use noble lies or grand delusions, as he liked to call them, to lead them.
Yes. So you're actually referring to the, you said neo-fascist, but you aren't those the, neoconservatives, the ones you're talking about? Okay.
Exactly. Yeah, the neoconservatives, but basically, so the neoconservatives, well, it's the CIA that has them on the CIA. And the neoconservatives work hand in hand. And the CIA, as I said, has been nurturing the fascist international to carry forward their strategies. Like, so Muslim Brotherhood is an example. The Gladio Network is another example. So yes, it's the strategy was spearheaded by the neoconservatives. But even the neoconservatives, they themselves were all formerly leftists who were doing the bidding of the CIA right up until the early 70s, before they switched to the other end of the political spectrum. They were led by William Kristol, and who was a Trotskyite, but in the employ of the CIA, as a number of them were. This was the use of what the CIA called the non-communist left. So they were communists who were opposed to Stalinism. This is a whole other tangent that I go to, but basically that creates the groundwork for this international fascist network. So, but again, in the early 80s, when Reagan comes to power, there's this push, international push, to spread the ideas of neoliberalism through the Mont Pelerin Society, which is a synarchist organization again. And so in the U.S., they use the Heritage Foundation. And so in a number of other influential right-wing Christian right foundation. But there, so all these organizations were then in turn funded by the various right-wing foundations like the Bradley and Olin Foundation and so on and so forth, who in turn all derive their funding from ExxonMobil, which is the chief Rockefeller corporation and the most, I think, by market cap, the largest corporation in the world, or had been for until recently, very recently. So this is the continuity of the Rockefeller relationship. Now, so I mentioned earlier when I talked about Higham, it was Standard Oil who were largely responsible through I.G. Farben for bringing the Nazis to power. But elsewhere, Rockefeller power begins with the Round Table organizations, principally the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a sister organization of the RIIA, the Royal Institute for International Affairs. And that's basically the seat of their power. So throughout this time, and basically the CIA itself was basically an arm of the Rockefeller family. So what happens now is that the Heritage Foundation now is exploiting the loyalty of, because before this time, the Christian community in the United States was largely apolitical. So basically their attempt was to transform them and to politicize them. And they did so by packaging their ideology as basically pro-Christian and anti-communist. And this is how they were able to sell their neoliberal principles. Because what's happened now is that conservatism for the last 300 years or so, however long it's been around, has tended to mean conservatism in a traditional sense, which maintenance of the status quo and so on and so forth. And what has happened is that, you know, I'm not the one mentioning this myself, but I get quotes in my book to show to in support of what I'm saying. But American conservatism is actually not traditional conservatism. It's actually neoliberalism, which has been packaged as conservatism by the conservatives.
Yes, it has. And right. And today's liberalism is just communism. Because the, well...
Yes, but that's different from neoliberalism.
Yes, exactly. The traditional sense, the traditional meaning of the word liberal is actually conservative thoughts and lifestyles.
Right. Yeah. So basically how Americans are, the Christian community is basically being radicalized by fascist ideas, which originated with the Mont Pelerin Society and are known as neoliberalism.
Yes.
These are the essential strategies for American imperialism, you know, articulated by people like Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman. And this is why there's always this constant collaboration between the CIA and the World Bank, work hand in hand to serve American imperialism. And the underlying philosophy that they use is neoliberalism.
Well, do you think it's not so much American imperialism, but just older European-rooted imperialism?
Yeah. Well, yes, I have to agree with that. When I don't mean, you know, truly American.
Oh, yes. I know what you're saying.
American people.
I know what you're saying, yeah.
Parasites that are using America.
Yes, I know what you're saying. What's he talking about America bad for? Well, it's exactly. Not really America. It's older... Eastern European interest. It's,
yeah. Exactly. The same, well, Illuminati or whatever you want to call it.
Right, right. Yeah.
These globalist parasites. Yeah.
There is a question from the chat. I said I would ask, but I think I know what the answer is. You're not part of any kind of government agency or anything like that, like Able Danger or anything? Or?
No.
Okay, I didn't really think so. You're just a researcher.
I have no affiliation to any organization whatsoever.
Yeah, you're just an author and a regular guy, right? But yeah, this is all very, very interesting stuff. I've had this conspiratorial mindset for about 5 years now since I've been doing all this, David. That the CIA and many, many top corporate interests, well, they're characterized as the military-industrial complex here in America, but I think both the CIA and the military-industrial complex run the American government.
Absolutely. They run the media.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There, a lot of times, somebody will get out of the military and, they're hand-picked and they're told where to go and they're told what their job's going to be, and whether it's media or, a handler for somebody in Congress or the Senate or some other high executive.
Exactly. I mean, that's, you know, the trick is that, you know, spies, you know, by the very nature of their career is to pull, is to make sure that nobody knows they're spies. Right? I mean,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's the reality of it. You have people in all kinds of positions of power. Yeah, I was just reading about George Bush and, you know, probably the story about how long he was with the CIA before he was ever supposed to have been with the CIA.
Daddy Bush, you mean?
He started out with Zapata Oil, which is sort of close to Cuba. I know.
That was in '59, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but had no affiliation to the CIA whatsoever. So, you know, and the CIA, I mean, they're career liars. Like they basically, it's part of their job description to lie and to.
It is, yeah. They're supposed to be secretive, and you. If you're exposed on something, the only way you can keep a secret is to lie about it.
To lie about it, and they will. So, you know, you can't really ask them to confirm anything.
Well, the thing was in 63, in November, when Daddy Bush went to Dallas, I believe the story goes that 6 months prior to there, the CIA hired somebody, oddly enough, named George Bush.
That's right. Exactly.
So, yeah. Six months later, when he's in the, or when he's asked about being in Dallas, and he goes, "Oh no, that wasn't me. Must have been somebody else."
Yeah, I think he said he didn't remember where he was on that day.
Yeah.
You know, the funny thing is that
there's pictures of him.
Fixation of American culture that everybody remembers where they were on that day.
Yes, they were. Yes, they do. And there's pictures of him there too. Anyways, but that's another rabbit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's get back to. More of a Hitler. I don't remember what your character.
You know what's interesting. What's interesting about this tangent we're talking about is that the leader of the neoconservatives is Michael Ledeen.
Okay.
So Michael Ledeen, he got his start basically connected with the P2 Masonic Lodge in Italy that was part of an Alexander Haig who were spearheading the Gladio Network in Italy. So that's where the connection between the synarchist fascist connection and the CIA and the neoconservatives basically starts out. You know, from what I understand, the way I see it is that he was practicing. Because the first thing, basically, Ledeen, for most of his career, his job was to serve as a fearmonger. He was constantly pointing to some kind of conspiracy here or there. He was one of the main people to exaggerate this, what they call the Bulgarian connection, I think, where the guy who attempted to assassinate John Paul II was connected to a Grey Wolves organization, which had links to Bulgaria, so it was actually a secretly Soviet-funded international terror network. Because at the time, this is how America was building its case, particularly in support of its war in Afghanistan, was to create this myth of the what they call the terror network, which was supposedly an international Soviet-funded international network of terrorists, or that the Soviets were principally responsible for the funding of terrorists. So once the Soviet Union was defeated, then of course the focus turned to the Islamic world. So then the Islamic world were the producers of the terrorists. So Michael Ledeen was a chief agent in all of that. But again, he connects. So he connects. The fascist, the neoconservatives of the fascist tradition, and most importantly, the P2 Masonic Lodge. You know about this one?
No, I don't. This is a lot of this is new to me, David.
P2 is a fascinating case. This is what doesn't happen in the United States. P2, you know, people talk about the Illuminati and try to dismiss the influence of Masonry and so on and so forth, but P2 is a modern day case which was brought to the highest level courts in Italy, which caused a national scandal for I don't know how much time in the media in Italy. So, you know, it came to public attention in a way that you've never seen in the United States. So basically this secret, supposedly illegal lodge of Freemasonry had recruited people from all ranks of society and who were involved in all kinds of, I guess, illegal activities. People have to read up on the details. But anyway, they were closely connected with what's called the strategy of tension. So the strategy of tension essentially was a CIA plot with the assistance of NATO, as I said, to use stay-behind units or fascist networks. What they were doing is that they were carrying out terrorist plots or terrorist bombings and then blaming them on the communists to try to discredit the Communist Party, in this case in Italy, but they were doing the same thing in other parts of Europe. So this is where you get things like basically they hijacked the Red Brigades, involves the assassination of Aldo Moro, and most importantly, the famous bombing, the Bologna train station bombing in 1982, which killed, I think, upwards of 70 innocent people. So this was all part of what they considered a strategy of tension. Basically, it's the fascist notion of perpetual war. You know, you have to keep people in constant fear of this manufactured threat in order to control them. And in this case, in particular, this was part of the CIA's anti-communist strategy.
Yeah.
In Italy.
I can tell you a funny little story there. My stepdad's 73, and he's told me on many, many occasions that his junior year civics teacher told him and the class that America had to have a war every 10 years just to sustain its economic stance. Yeah, just to pay the bills.
Yeah.
Franz wanted to know if you know about George Bush being the Shiznit Sherf or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Being like his true name being Sherf?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
There's this is a really weird story. This is, I can't remember what the author's name, but he's a writer who wrote a book, and he claimed that Otto Skorzeny had showed up. Somehow he met Otto Skorzeny, who actually didn't die back in 73 or whatever year it was still alive. And he was bitter because he felt that he had betrayed, so he wanted to reveal his secrets. And he started spilling the beans, apparently, claiming that Hitler was alive and identifying people as secret Nazis and so on and so forth, claiming that George Bush was actually George Sherf. And he had this bizarre story about how George Bush actually worked as an apprentice for Nikola Tesla, and that's where the idea from Curious George came from. So, you know, to tell you the truth, I contacted that author and I started asking him some questions, and I got some very bizarre answers, and nothing
concrete
of any worth.
Nothing concrete, yeah.
So, you know, in the picture he supplied of Otto Skorzeny didn't look very much like him at all. And his claim was that those days they all had plastic surgery done. So, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, yeah, it just wasn't believable. So, no, I don't buy into it. But that doesn't deny the fact that, you know, the Bush family has longstanding ties with the Nazis.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't excuse anything. Even if his name is George Bush or...
Yeah, I mean, the Skull and Bones is a Nazi organization. And, you know, and really this is what we, you know, Nazism is basically, the Nazis were basically just the first New Age political order. You know, the Nazi philosophy was a New Age movement. It was an early version of it. And this is why my, you know, the third name in my subtitle is the New Age. It's Islam, Fascism, and New Age. Fascism is an outgrowth of it. But there's a continuing relationship between fascism and the fascist Nazism and the New Age. It's the same ideology. You know, the New Age is basically it's an Aryan philosophy about Atlantis and, you know, the power of the Aryan Age, power of the Aryans, and so on and so forth. The coming of an age of Aquarius. This is all because Nazism and New Age have their origin in Blavatsky and Theosophy, as does the UFO movement, which is why it's so closely linked to the Nazi mythos.
Yes, definitely. It's just a lot of crazy stuff that
It is.
I don't know. It's really difficult to reach people. They can read or see. It doesn't really matter. They might see a dozen sources and still disregard it as BS.
Yeah.
Do you have difficulty reaching people or
It depends. There's degrees of success. I find, like to give a perfect example, in my personal everyday life, forget it.
Yes, me too.
It's useless. My family, my
Yeah.
friends, work acquaintances,
Yeah.
anywhere around, forget it. If I
Do you
even
know?
start talking about my what I know, they'll just look at me like I'm nuts.
Yeah, do you know why that is? Your family and your friends know who you are. They've seen you stumble. They've seen, you know, they've seen you in your bed. They know what you're all about, and they just don't see you as a reliable source.
There's part of that, but what I guess what I mean is that it's the internet gives us the opportunity to connect with like-minded people.
Yes, it does.
Right. So if let's say in my community, if there's 0.1% of the population that would be conspiracy interested, that means like two people, right? Whereas, so on the internet, if I can connect with 2% of the world's population, that means thousands of people, or hundreds of thousands. So that's what the difference is.
Oh,
I
I
find
would.
that, I am connecting, and I do meet a lot of people who are interested, like genuinely interested, all the time. But that interaction is almost entirely through the net.
Yes, I would take 1/10 of 1% of the world's population as listeners, because that would still be tens of thousands of listeners.
Exactly. So it's
Yes.
better than just being a lone voice in the wilderness.
I think most everybody has seen the TV shows or the movies back when they were young, where there would be somebody standing on the corner just shouting about
With the sandwich board.
They're coming after us.
World is
They're
coming. That's right.
coming to get us. Get prepared now. And always in the TV show or the movie, the people just walk by and disregard that voice.
I met a guy like that in Toronto, a fascinating guy. He used to actually, he did exactly that. He wore a placard every day he walked down the street, and it used to say, I can't remember what it said exactly, but I finally stopped him in the street, and he talked about how he had been diagnosed with schizophrenia and that he was exposed to all kinds of experiments from the CIA and so on and so forth. So entirely believable stuff, of course, but to the rest of the world, he was nuts.
Well,
And
schizophrenia, that can be that can be a made up diagnosis by a doctor who's bad anyway, so.
absolutely. And this is what I was discussing with my wife last week, is that the MK Ultra was developed from a study in schizophrenia.
It was.
What's fascinating too is that this is the other what I talk about in my book, is that the leading doctor at the time was Werner Overholtzer, and he was based at the St. Elizabeth Hospital in Washington. So he was Ezra Pound's doctor, and it was Ezra Pound who influenced Eustace Mullins to write his Federal Reserve book. So this is how these connections work. And it's basically that St. Elizabeth Hospital was the MK Ultra hospital. Most of the serial killers were treated there, like John Hinckley Jr. and so on and so forth.
Yes, they were. Most of them were. Charles Manson. Well, maybe not treated at that hospital, but I think his doctor, and also Sirhan Sirhan, he was treated by MK Ultra doctor.
So yeah, that's the mystery of what they call schizophrenia, but it basically has to do with multiple personality disorder,
Yeah, and bipolar too.
all that stuff. So
I don't know. You know, I've never been treated by well, I can't say never, but it wasn't for very long. But that's I know some of them drugs that they give you, they can give you feelings of suicidal.
Right.
That's the truth.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But no, I've been off them drugs a long time now, so.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, that's why when you look at the proliferation of drugs these days, you know, you can see what they're up to. And people are celebrating the legalization of marijuana like it's a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the thing is that MKUltra started by investigating many drugs, and one of the first few drugs that they started investigating was marijuana, and they actually concluded that it was successful in rendering their subject loquacious in quote unquote in their own terms. But then, you know, they finally discovered LSD, and that was their preferred
Yeah.
option. But
And other exotic drugs too, yeah.
yeah, and that's the thing is that it's, you know, drugs are now, this is why. Drugs and mysticism, drugs have always been a primary tool of mysticism. You know, they're an essential tool of mysticism and this is why they have been repackaged as mind expanding tools. And yeah, so that's basically how they're selling. It's basically a counterfeit of religion.
Oh yeah, sorry about that. Geez, I'm not sure where I was gonna go now. Where else could we go?
I don't know. Well, you know, this brings us back to the UFO subject anyway.
Does it? MK Ultra and UFOs?
Yeah.
How's that?
Well, because it goes back to the synarchist idea, right? Synarchism, do you know what theurgy is?
No, I don't.
So theurgy is basically, it's a branch of magic which has to do with establishing communication with quote-unquote gods or what are interpreted in occult circles as gods, but which are, however you want to call them, discarnate entities. And this begins with, again, as I said, synarchism begins with Martinism. So throughout the history of Freemasonry, there's always been the concept of what are called hidden superiors or hidden masters. So that's, you know, it was, who was it, what's his name, who wrote the Illuminati trilogy? Robert Anton Wilson. He said that he was told that the ultimate secret of Freemasonry is that the Brotherhood is in contact with beings from Sirius.
Is
And this
that
explains, pardon?
right? Is that right?
Yeah. So this is where it all evolves from. So what happens in the occult revival is Blavatsky preached against what she defined the excessive materialism of the period, which in a way was true. Science had become overly skeptical and denied the existence of basically the possibility of the existence of God. But she used it to excuse it, to say that science denied the existence of the quote-unquote supernatural. And so what became popular at the time was the holding of seances and to make contact with beings who were defined in all kinds of ways. They were either defined as the souls of departed people, of ancestors, sometimes the famous people from the past, like you could contact Julius Caesar or Joan of Arc or something like that. Another interpretation is that they were beings from other planets. And this is how theosophy served to develop this notion of making contact with beings from other planets. And again, this had always been part of Freemasonry, or at the top, I guess the secret is that they're in contact with these discarnate entities. So synarchism is the belief that society should be ruled by the mystics, the elite mystics of secret societies who are in contact with the gods as they see them. And according to Synarchy, these gods reside in Agartha, which is a hollow earth, and blah, 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 blah. So that's what they see. So, you know, what really happens is that these guys make contact with some kind of entity and they become proud of themselves. They start to feel special that, oh wow, you know, they've experienced something that the rest of society doesn't recognize. And then they excuse the fact that, oh, no one will understand if we explain it to them, so we have to keep it secret. Except that they're being duped into thinking that these entities are what they say they are, which is our gods. And, you know, I'm not sure how much of this you're going to believe what I'm saying, but basically this is why these quote unquote gods are always identified with the fallen angels. with Lucifer as their leader.
Right.
Blavatsky, she specifically identified the gods that she was in contact with as the fallen angels whose leader was Lucifer. So this becomes the basis of the Cernarchist tradition. And again, this was the same idea that was being taught by Julius Evola, who was who inspired the Gladio networks of Italy. So there's a lot of tangents here, but because it's hard to encapsulate the scope of this idea. We really have to understand that the basis of mysticism going back 6,000 years has always been to make contact with spirits. So when you look at, you know, what I call the dying god rituals of ancient time, you know, the ancient mysteries of the first millennium and so on and so forth, Mithraism, the Gnostics, so on, it always had to do with achieving contact with the gods or the god who possessed the human being or spoke through him and things like this. And so to occultists, they recognize that. They recognize that this is the ultimate goal that they're trying to achieve. They practice ritual to make contact with these discarded entities. So Cernarchism basically is a translation of this age-old belief in spirit contact, but turning it into, in their minds, a political system that could be applied in reality. So MK Ultra, this is where we get back to Gurdjieff, who's a key character in this entire story. Because Gurdjieff, first of all, we have Blavatsky. Blavatsky identified Tibetan Buddhism as the truest representation of magical tradition because it inherited Central Asian shamanism. This idea was repeated by Gurdjieff, who identified what he called a Sarnrung brotherhood who lived in Central Asia, who continued, again, the shamanistic tradition. So this is why you have this interest in shamanism, which began to be popularized by the Esalen Institute, particularly by a scholar by the name of Mirkei Ilyed, who belonged to the group, same group that Julius Evola belonged to. So this idea of shamanism was the belief that the ancient shamans used to take drugs to achieve contact with otherworldly entities. And this became the underlying basis for the CIA's pursuit of the MK Ultra program. People usually interpret it as a mind control program, but that's not really entirely what it was. So for them, it was the belief that using drugs this is why they started with magic mushrooms. The people like Gordon Wasson and Andrea Parch and people like that were all affiliated with the CIA, who first identified the mushroom, but then eventually it became LSD. So this is why they marketed it as as mind expanding. But ultimately, what was supposed to happen is that these drugs allowed you to make contact with discarded entities, which is precisely the predicament that schizophrenics are subjected to. Hearing voices and so on and so forth is basically the same thing as what has been characterized in the past as a mystical experience. So that explains MKUltra's interest in schizophrenia. So this is why, you know, the first few decades of MKUltra was largely focused on using and promoting LSD, and they produced the 60s counterculture through the rock and roll music and Beatles. It's, you know, the what's it called, the scene in Laurel Canyon and so on and so forth to popularize the use of drugs as mind expanding. But eventually what happened is that secretly the CIA was also conducting what they called remote viewing experiments as an extension of the MKUltra program. So basically this was using psychics to make contacts with these beings and to remote view in various places and so on and so forth. So this is how this is going to get too complicated to cover today, but basically this is where a lot of this Egyptology came from,
right?
And this brings us back to the idea of why the Masons believe they're in contact with beings from Sirius, because this was the influence behind a lot of these so-called new Egyptologists like Robert Bovell, Graham Hancock, and that whole crew of writers who are trying to claim that the pyramids were built in alignment with Orion and, you know, the Sirius mystery and books like this. This is all Masonic influence and Blavatsky influence and Cernarchist influence. And this is why you find now that this MKUltra idea now is evolving into the notion that drugs help you to make contact with not just being, you know, beings from other planets. So essentially, the shamans were used drugs to contact extraterrestrials. And so basically, this is how all of this stuff has evolved to fabricate the UFO mythos. As a way of what Alice Bailey called the externalization of the hierarchy. It's basically the same kind of mysticism that has been practiced for 6,000 years, except now it's being marketed as contact with ETs.
That's what I was going to ask you, David. What your thoughts on all that were, whether it was just BS or whether there was some validity to it or not.
Well, you know, I'm going to have to tell you what I believe personally. And the thing is, you know, I am a Muslim, as I confessed many times. And in Islam, there's a belief in what are called jinn, or have been popularized in your Western literature as genies.
Genies, yeah.
So, you know, these have been interpreted in other traditions as demons, except that demons kind of carries this connotation that they're inherently evil. But they're not evil. They're just beings. They're discarnate beings, and they have free will just like human beings. So some of them are good and some of them are not. And so this is what the purpose of mysticism is basically they make contact with these beings, except that these beings, when they're malevolent, fool them to think that they're gods. And this is why the experience has always been consistent for, you know, as I said, thousands of years. So and what has happened is, excuse me, I'm losing my voice now. After, for the last century, this has been the underlying beliefs of theosophy, and they have been marketing it essentially as the New Age movement. So if a very important book on this subject is Jacques Vallée's book, Messengers of Deception. Jacques Vallée, basically, he recognized that something must be going on. So he set out to what he thought he was going to do was prove it to be true, prove that people were, in fact, must have been making contact with something, and what they were saying must have been true. But what he came to recognize is that the public image of what was supposedly happening had nothing to do with the actual reports of the people who did make that contact. So what he recognizes is that the experiences that people were having, you know, people weren't walking on physical ships. They were seeing lights. They were hearing voices. They were having out-of-body experiences and so on and so forth. But he finally had to conclude that these are not extraterrestrials. These are intraterrestrials. And he concluded that these must be experiences that can be compared to experiences that have been reported throughout the centuries with ghouls, goblins, leprechauns, you know, ghosts, and so on and so forth. So that's basically what's happening. So what you find is that most of the so-called ET contact tends to be telepathic, in their own words. In other words, they hear a voice, or it's channeling mainly, so that this spirit from another planet is speaking through the person. And what they tend to communicate is theosophy, and often, frankly, Aryan ideas, because Blavatsky's teachings, Blavatsky is the one principally responsible for developing the notion, the occult notion of an Aryan race. And so this is what's happening. And when you find that most of the reports, the supposed reports of ET contact, or many of them, tend to be government fabricated, like the MJ-12 documents and so on and so forth. But so that's basically the gist of it. You know, yeah. A very important organization to follow in the manufacture of all this and its connection with the CIA is the Esalen Institute.
Echelon.
So I would recommend to anybody who's interested to read the Stargate Conspiracy by Picknett and Prince.
Pardon? I'm sorry, by who?
The Picknett and Prince, Clive Prince.
Okay.
And or also Esalen, what's it called? Esalen, The Religion of No Religion. And that's by Jeffrey Kripal, I think. That one is a much more scholarly book, but it's excellent. And it talks well.
Yeah.
It's great insight. So the Esalen Institute, this is where the CIA slipped into manufacturing the UFO phenomenon, because beginning, I think, in 1948 with Andrea Poharich, they started making contact with a group of entities who referred to themselves as the Nine, or the Council of Nine. And again, as I said, MKUltra grew of this idea that drugs could help you achieve contact with with ETs. And this is what Andrea Pohart's mission was, and this is why he started with magic mushrooms. So anyway, so they made contact with these entities, and the entities eventually claimed that they were the gods of ancient Egypt, the Inuit that were worshipped by the ancient Egyptians. And and then these same entities then were contacted regularly by the Esalen Institute. In fact, I found a document from my camera just a couple of years ago that describes the entire session of this contact of channeling the Council of Nine. And that's what essentially what the Stargate conspiracy discusses, but in a lot more detail that exposes most of the writers associated with this, the manufacture of these ideas.
Sorry about that. That was a statement earlier. What would you say to the statement that Blavatsky? I have to go up to it. The chat room is going very, very fast, and I have to find it. Every time somebody says something, it moves down.
Right.
I gotta find it. Where is this? Oh, Blavatsky was being instructed. I'm sorry. Blavatsky was not being instructed by Lucifer, but by Kuhumi, yeah. Lal Singh, and Moria, and others.
Yeah. So that's like as an example. You know, this is what she called her ascended masters. So, you know, this is what I'm saying, is that these beings that are contacted, they're interpreted in various ways. So some people will say they're contacting their lost wife or their grandparent or Julius Caesar, Genghis Khan, and so on and so forth. So Blavatsky's version was that she was in contact with Kuhumi and these various other masters. But essentially it's the same thing. So I didn't say that she said she was in contact with Lucifer, but basically she said she was in contact with the Great White Brotherhood, and they were located in Shambhala.
Okay.
And this, they were headed by Sanat Kumara. And she specifically identified Sanat Kumara with Satan and said that they were falsely maligned by Christianity or the Christian church, and that they were one and the same with the fallen angels.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting stuff here. We've only got about 3 minutes left in the show, David.
Yeah.
You want to plug your books and whatever websites we can find you at?
Thanks. So my main website is terrorism-illuminati.com, and that's where I post most of my recent articles. I try to post stuff regularly that covers material in my book, because my book is pretty big. It's unfortunately 600 pages. I tried to keep it shorter, but it wasn't possible. So I try to tease my audience a little bit to try to give them tidbits of what I cover to hopefully pique their interest. So there's also links to find my book, which is available on Amazon or any other major online retailer. I've also got a Kindle version available, and I have a Facebook page. And so a link to that is also on my website, which again is terrorism-illuminati.com.
You mean terrorism/illuminati?
Hyphen.
Yeah. Okay. I must have did something wrong, because I finally got it to come up, but...
Okay.
Yes, okay. There it is. Black Terror, White Soldiers.
Yeah. Yeah, if you Google Terrorism Illuminati, my website will go up.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm going to pop that link in the chat there. What do you have coming up? You doing any writing or more researching?
I don't know. You know, I usually have no idea when my next book is coming, because I usually write what I discover, and I finish writing when the thread that I'm following is I've taken it to its conclusion. So, no, nothing yet. I'm starting to study little tidbits here and there. And usually what happens is that these little threads start to connect, and then I start to follow it. But I'm not at that point yet.
What kind of direction do you think you'll go?
I'd like to explore more in depth this, the connections with fascism and the origins of fascism and things like that. Because I think I only I think I only touched the surface in my latest book, and I think it's a lot deeper than that. And I think that's the true trajectory to follow to actually, because what I discovered while what's really going on, particularly like I said, the Esalen Institute, its links with Gurdjieff, with Muslims, with the New Age, with Sufis, with the UFO phenomenon, and so on and so forth. Even the Christian right, conspiracy culture, all these interconnections, I think explain what's really happening. But this is the first that I've discovered of it. So I've touched on it in my latest book, but I think there's more that can be found for sure.
Yeah. So you're going to go even more than the almost 700 pages in.
Yeah. Well, hopefully not. I mean, like my latest book couldn't exist without my last one. So
right.
I was able to omit a lot of details from Terrorism and the Illuminati to cover in Black Terror, White Soldier. So, you know, that's what I try to do is I try to minimize the amount of information that I have to go through as much as possible. I just try to
Yes. And there we are, David. I appreciate you coming on, David, once again. And thanks once again, David. David Livingstone.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, and so we will see. Well, actually, I have one more hour to do, so we'll be right back after the break. Yes. I thought I should have been hearing music already, but I don't know. I'll just go ahead and sign off for the day. Thank you, everybody at Revolution Radio. It's been a great show. Thank David Livingstone, and thanks Suzanne Pozell. I'm Stephen Roberts, and this has been Revolution Radio's Cancel the Cabal. I'm just going to let the studio go and say goodnight, everyone.